This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. And last week we talked about the International Space Station's nifty new espresso machine. Get it? ISS, espresso machine. They also had a bulbous, nose-shaped, zero-gravity coffee cup, which allows astronauts to sip their drinks in zero gravity. But they are more than just sipping coffee up there. There is a microbiome experiment studying, does space change the community of bugs that live in your gut? Think about it, and then don't think about it. And experiments on how plants know to grow in the right direction, and it's not just the sunlight that we talk about here. And investigations on how your genes interact with zero gravity. Now we have the famous Kelly twins, Mark and Scott, as the test subjects. Mark is here on Earth, and Scott is up there in space for a year. They're going to be up there comparing notes with the ground. And then there's one of my favorite, the suction pants experiment, which, well, we'll talk about that with my next guest, NASA's chief scientist for the International Space Station program, Julie Robinson. She's based at Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston. She came all the way here to Huntsville. Thank you to be with us today. Glad to have you. Dr. Robinson, thanks for joining us. There's so many things going on up there that we don't hear much about, except the espresso machine.
Yeah, what can I say? The press doesn't always want to cover the most exciting science. They want to cover the most popular science.
You know, when I was reading about this, some of the exciting stuff, especially how zero gravity might affect the genetics of the people up there. We had never thought about that before, did we?
Right. I mean, now we're in the age of personalized medicine now. You know, doctors are starting to test your genes before they decide what to prescribe. It's hitting cancer therapy, all of that. And it's hitting us in space as well, because not every person is reacting to the space environment the same way. And as we start to understand that better, someday it's going to influence who we send to Mars, for example. Maybe not everybody has got the right genes to go that far and be subject to all that radiation and be alone such a long time.
Right. So we learn things that we never expected. We never expect a lot of things out of zero G, but things pop out, right?
One great example that popped out about 4 years ago was that there are some astronauts, not every astronaut, and mostly the men, not really the women, that have permanent vision loss after being in space. A lot of astronauts have some vision decline when they're on orbit, but when they come home, there's a few that never don't get better, don't recover. And what we've learned over the last 4 years is that their optic nerve is swelling, the pressure in their brain, basically the pressure of the fluids in their brain is going up. Their optic nerve swells. It compresses their eyeball so it's not round anymore. And it can cause cotton wool spots and disrupt the retina. It's this whole process, and we missed it for all these, 30 years, 40 years of human spaceflight. We didn't even realize that
was going on. Yeah, because we used to talk about you maybe lose some calcium, your bones atrophy a little bit, but never these other kinds of...
So bone loss we've known about
for a long time, and that's one that we're actually solving. So we've had astronauts now come home from the space station that with the right level of exercise, high-intensity resistive exercise, not running on a treadmill, the right vitamin D, and the right calories, eating a fair amount of food, they come home without losing bone mass density, and that's actually an incredible achievement for mankind to get off of the planet.
I think a lot of people want to get into space here. What can we learn from the Kelly twins? What's the biggest thing that we're hoping for?
Well, you know, the thing that's really a breakthrough with the Kelly twins builds on the one-year expedition that we're doing with our Russian colleagues. So, you know, Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko, a cosmonaut, are both going to spend 1 year on the International Space Station. And we're bringing the two medical research programs of the U.S. and Russia together and doing joint experiments on things like fluid shifts, on the eye issue I just talked about. Once we had selected Scott for the one-year expedition, he and Mark came to us and said, hey, you know, don't scientists do things with twins? Aren't twins a good way to understand things? We'd love to volunteer. And that was a huge breakthrough for us, because we're always pretty careful at NASA about looking at genetic data. You know, astronauts are employees. They're covered by a federal act called GINA that doesn't let you use genetic information about your employees. And so until they had come to us, we really had not started dealing with all of the ethical issues. And they were really open to having their, basically their genes sequenced, having people look at all of these different levels, what proteins they're making, what RNA is coming out, even their gut microbiome. We're looking at both the microbiome of the astronauts, but also the way that microbes colonize the space station as a whole as new vehicles come up. It's one of the most closed systems in the world. Anything that gets there is going to pretty much stay there until it gets filtered out by the HEPA filters. So it makes a great laboratory for studying microbes.
Why would we have different protein expression if we're in space? What does our body think is happening that it changes gears?
Yeah. So one of the things that happens at a cellular level is there are certain cells that are responding to, say, muscle tension. If you look at your bones are always recycling themselves. If they didn't recycle themselves, they'd become brittle and they'd just break. And so there's a type of cell that actually feels the tension at a cellular level between your muscle cells and the bone and says, boy, you know, I should do some work here. I should build some bone. And if that tension isn't there, it doesn't work the same way. So really understanding that tension between the cells that chew up bone and the cells that build bone is where a lot of the focus has been on bone loss research over the last 10 years.
All right, we have a question in the audience. Let's go right here to the front. Yes, sir.
Yeah, we're talking about some of the effects of zero gravity. And to date, I guess, it's been combated primarily by extensive exercise and pharmacological approaches and things like that. But Dr. Ashton Grable did a lot of research several years ago in using artificial gravity, and that, of course, has shown up in movies like 2001 Space Odyssey. Is there any work going on in that area nowadays?
Yeah, artificial gravity is something NASA's looked at several times over the years, and the big problem with artificial gravity is you've got to design your spacecraft system. Well, it's got two problems. One is the spacecraft system side and one is the human system side. So you've got to design your spacecraft system to work in spinning mode and to work if it breaks and isn't spinning anymore, which means the physics has to work for zero gravity and the physics has to work for spinning. And that's an engineering challenge. So that makes a spacecraft much more expensive to build. And you know how well that goes over.
Yeah.
But on the human system side, when you're spinning, if you guys think 2001 A Space Odyssey is how it would feel, you're wrong. Think Ferris wheel, think, tilt-a-whirl, because your brain and your sensory system does not like to have these Coriolis effects on your body. So if you're centrifuging around and you turn your head a little bit to the side, you're going to throw up. And so
I hate it when that happens.
So far, the idea of trying to design a 360-degree barf bag for a centrifuged astronaut was not working out so well.
Would it be possible in a large, space station or other place to grow fresh plants, the people that could eat fresh food?
So we are growing fresh plants in a little habitat called Veggie, and we just brought enough samples home. Everybody was worried about the microbiome part of that, see? So the first set we grew, the docs wouldn't let the astronauts eat them because they wanted to bring them home and make sure they were clean enough. We just got approval. So the next set that grow are okay to eat, the next lettuce.
It's going to be lettuce? What's it going to be?
I think the plan is lettuce, but yeah. We haven't confirmed that yet. So
yeah. It's not integrated into the waste system for vegetation.
No.
No.
But, you know, the amazing thing about plants is that when you look at the genes that turn on when they're in space, they're kind of the same genes that turn on when they're water stressed.
They think there's a drought, same kind of genes that get turned on?
So, and there's a lot going on with plants because they're in space, the liquid doesn't go to the bottom of the container. So there's all of this water everywhere with air bubbles everywhere, and the roots feel like they're drowning as well. So there's a lot of work going on there to try and understand, you know, what is this stress response? And how quickly does it happen? There are even scientists that have done a lot of work on the space station. They decided to see how fast does the plant know it's in space. And so they did some work on a sounding rocket, and they were measuring electrical impulses in the cells and found it was almost instantaneous as they went up.
They knew they were in space, or they started reacting with the stress?
They started reacting. You could see the gene reactions change. The gene transcription would change.
Wow. Do we have a question in the audience? Yes, sir.
On the subject of the ISS twin study, there are some effects that can be expected, such as the calcium loss that you had mentioned earlier, but are there any effects that are less well documented that you're interested in looking at or just looking to show?
Yeah, that's a great question. Two of our biggest risks as we look ahead at going to Mars are radiation, because you know, even on the space station, we're still partly inside the Earth's magnetosphere. So we're in a gentler environment. It's not as gentle as here on the Earth's surface, but it's a little bit gentler. And as you go on a transit to Mars, you're pretty much in open space and really exposed for a while. And so that radiation risk is one thing. A second thing we're really concerned about is what we call behavioral health and performance. And that's something that engineers aren't real comfortable with because it's not the hard, firm, data-driven type science maybe that most engineers are comfortable with. But the fact is, if you're on a mission to Mars for 3 years and you're with a handful of other people and you're stuck with them and things get tense and things go wrong and halfway through the mission you really wish you could quit, there's not a lot you can do about that. And so so understanding how to select the right crews, how to give them the right support, they can't call home from Mars like they could from the space station. You know, on the space station, they just call their families on the satellite phone.
You know, in the early days of living, I remember when I was in Antarctica 30 years ago, in the early days of what they used to call wintering over, you couldn't leave Antarctica for 6 months either.
Right.
And they started actually started documenting people who were going a little nutty, as they called it. You know, and there was a depression they go through and whatever. This sounds like you're in the early days of that same kind of research.
Right. And so we have studies that'll be going on that help the astronauts to assess their own state of mind. Especially, you can imagine on a Mars mission, an astronaut needs to be able to assess themselves because they can't. The delay of communication with the ground could really interfere with getting a lot of support. You know, talking with Scott Kelly before he went up, he was really realizing this is so different than the six-month mission he did. When he did a six-month mission, he said at about 4 months in, he'd had the experience. He was kind of done with it, and then he just had to soldier on. And that's actually been scientifically documented. It's called the third quarter effect. It happens to marathon runners as well. You know, when you're through the first half, and then you think, oh, my God, I've got to do this again.
You hit the wall.
And so he's really thinking actively about how is he going to deal with that in this mission. What happens, he asked me, what happens if at 4 months I feel the same way I did the last time?
But at least you can predict it now. It's sort of more of a science that you know what's going to happen, you know to expect it, and other people around you know that that might happen.
Right. But part of what we do on the space station is it's not just predicting the problem, it's finding a way to alleviate the problem. We call that a countermeasure. We've got to do something to get that risk down enough that we think that mission is going to be good to go.
Julie Robinson is chief scientist for the International Space Station, based at the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Julie Robinson, chief scientist for the International Space Station. You know, there are people who think that if we're going to Mars, it's a one-way trip. We should find people who are willing to go to Mars and be that be their last place that they go. They're not coming home. What is your view? What is NASA's view on this?
Well, I think we've
got there are thousands of people who are supposedly ready to do that.
And those people can do it on their own dime, but I think it's sort of the difference between the Lewis and Clark expedition and a personal trip to Mount Everest, right? And the Lewis and Clark expedition was a government-funded expedition to gain knowledge for the benefit of the nation. And we sent them, intending them to bring all that knowledge, the samples back and all of that, so that it really served the nation, not just them as human beings, to go do something cool. But an Everest expedition is generally a person raising their own money and paying for a personal experience, and they take a lot of personal risks and die. But that's not something that governments usually fund. So,
Let's see if we can go to the audience. Yes, right here.
Hi. I've got a question about disease on the International Space Station. Can other astronauts come up and pass, like, the common cold or the flu? Like new astronauts coming up, bringing up food or for example, other supplies?
Yeah, we worry about that a lot. All the astronauts are in a quarantine before they launch for a period of time, hoping that we won't bring up something like the common cold, but it has happened where somebody looked pretty good when they launched and they'd looked good all along and maybe they got an illicit kiss from one of their little kids or something like that, and they brought it up. And from the astronauts that have had colds in space, they say it's pretty miserable. The only way to clear your sinuses is to spin yourself around.
Ooh, okay. Do we worry that we might be bringing our germs to Mars if we go there? And they might run wild?
So, you know, there are folks at NASA that are sort of in charge of planetary protection, and they talk a lot about how all the things we're going to do to make sure we don't bring bacteria to Mars. But with my own background as an ecologist, I think a little more practically, and I just can't imagine that anything we send isn't going to have some bacteria on it. That's just my personal view.
It's going to, you know, as they said in the Jurassic Park, nature will find a way.
Nature finds a way.
Jeff Goldblum's famous line.
There'll be something.
Well, we have to expect to bring something there. One of the recent experiments on the International Space Station was 3D printing in space. So you could make stuff up there instead of ordering it from Earth. Did it work well? Was it okay?
It didn't work perfectly. And in fact, some of the guys you were talking to about the coffee cup, they had predicted it wouldn't work perfectly because they're experts. You know, Mark Weislogel is an expert in how surface tension forces of fluids dominate when you don't have gravity anymore. And so the things kind of stuck to the surface in ways we didn't expect and so forth, but we're going to work on some other materials and keep analyzing the way that the little droplets of fluid start interacting with each other. You know, when you think about the big picture, I would say 3D printing is one of the most important things we can do for becoming independent of Earth so that we can do a long-distance exploration mission, because you cannot take all the spare parts with you. And so if you're able to manufacture only the spare parts you need and any spare part you could happen to need, that makes a huge difference on the cost of a mission, the mass of a mission, and the safety of a mission. So it's really important.
Let's talk about suction pants. I'm not even going to go there. You just take the ball and run with that suction pants.
Well, so I talked about the eye issue, this idea that fluids are shifting up into the head and causing pressure that could damage the eyes. And, you know, those fluids are rising up because there's no gravity holding them down. Our bodies are adapted to be in 1G. And when astronauts we know well go up into space, they look funny to us, if you know them well. Their faces look puffy and their legs get really skinny. We call that chicken legs. So when they're wearing shorts or something like that, you go, oh, man, his legs got really skinny.
I'll be looking out for that now.
Yeah,
that I know
you got to watch for it.
Yeah.
And so this is something we've known about for a long time, but all of a sudden it has a new focus because it might be causing damage to the eyes. And that changes the whole landscape. It's not just something funny anymore. It could be something really serious. Our Russian colleagues for years and years have had a countermeasure that they use before their astronauts return to Earth that they think helps them to get used to the fluids coming back down in their legs when they land. And this is called the Chibis. And it's basically a set of pants that have lower body negative pressure, which is suction, essentially. Huh. And so what we're going to do on this one-year expedition for the first time, it's a really exciting study with both Scott and Mikhail, is have them in the Russian segment using the Chibis, and then have all of the American ultrasound equipment and the tomography, the eye measurement equipment, also in the Russian segment so that we can draw the fluid down and then see, does that affect the shape of the eye? Does that affect all the eye problems that we might be observing at the time? And also, do we see the fluids actually shifting or not? So we'll be able to image the blood vessels and really see if this is an important area to pursue.
You know, this sounds like the same problem that fighter pilots had in the early days of in the 50s of supersonic planes, because the blood would rush from their head and they'd black out when they're going, you know, doing a lot of G-forces, and they had to come up with spacesuits that would push the blood
back
up there. Sort of the same, but the opposite direction.
Yeah, it's the same set of problems.
Yeah.
And also, you know, pilots will do Valislava maneuvers so they don't pass out, you know, where they create some pressure in their heads to keep the blood there. Where one theory, which hasn't been proven on the eye issue, the vision issue, is that all this high-intensity resistive exercise that's protecting the astronauts' bones and has the osteoporosis research community here on Earth really interested might be contributing, because they're basically doing Valislava maneuvers when they're doing this high intensity exercise too. So that might make it worse.
Well, Dr. Robinson, I'm so glad you decided to come in from Houston to visit us.
It's always a pleasure to be here in Huntsville. It's our mission control for all the research, so it's good to be
here. Thank you. Julie Robinson is chief scientist for the International Space Station, based at the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. We won't be taking your calls today, but if you'd like to join our conversation this week, you can tweet us at SciFry or leave us a comment at sciencefriday.com. In the movie Interstellar, astronaut Cooper, played by Matthew McConaughey, blasts into interstellar space through a temporary wormhole.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system? To our galaxy. Here we go.
The controls won't work here. We're passing through the bulk. Space beyond our three dimensions.
Exciting stuff. But until we can travel through wormholes, we'll have to rely on the spacecraft we have. And in fact, we have gone interstellar. The Voyager spacecraft launched in the 1970s did cross over into the space between the stars, and that milestone only took, well, 36 years. How could we shave a few years off of that trip, and how might we visit Mars and beyond our galaxy in the future? My next guest dreams up answers to those questions. He's a NASA technologist at the Marshall Space Flight Center here in Huntsville. And in his spare time, he is a sci-fi writer and has co-authored the novels Rescue Mode and Back to the Moon. Les Johnson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I have to ask you, what did you think of the film?
It was an awesome film. We saw it at the night before it actually opened and had a panel discussion after the movie to talk about what was real and how we might actually go to the stars.
Well, yeah, what could we do? What might be too science fiction?
Well, I don't want to argue with Kip Thorne. I mean, he is like way up there in terms of the theory. But what we've looked at and what I've looked at are things that are more known physics, things that are that seem to be possible. Nature hasn't said you can't do it. Nature's just said it's going to be really, really hard to
do. Like what?
Well, there are all kinds of ways you can do that. One of the best ways would be something using antimatter. There in the world today, we have matter, and then there are these particles of matter, which are like what we have, protons that, instead of a positive charge, have a negative charge, electrons with positive charges. And when they come in contact with regular matter, they basically annihilate and become energy. And if you could tap that energy, you could drive a starship. Now, that's kind of far out. For me, I'm going to bring it to not quite as far out, but my favorite is something called a solar sail or a laser sail, which I think if we send a probe to another star first, it'll be done using a solar sail.
You mean just like a ship sail?
Well, I mean, it looks like a ship sail, yeah. But instead of the wind, it uses sunlight. Here in the audience or wherever you are, there's light reflecting from you. And you can't feel it, but as the light reflects from you, it's pushing on you. Light doesn't have rest mass, but it has momentum. And so just think of all these little ping pong balls bouncing off of you. And if you're out in space, away from the Earth's gravity and out of the air, as that light reflects from the sail, it's going to give it a small push.
It's like that toy radiometer that
Well,
goes
that's
in a
not
circle?
Actually how a radiometer works. That's a different process.
Yeah.
A lot of people bring that up as an example,
right.
But when you burrow into the physics, it's a slightly different physics there.
But there's enough pressure from the sun?
Oh, it's very small.
Yeah?
It's on the order of maybe an ounce and a half per football field of area. So it's a very, very small push. But the key is that the sun is always on, right?
Right.
And so it's a constant low thrust. And over time, you can build up a pretty high velocity. And if you augment that by flying really close to the sun, where you have a lot more light shining on your sail.
And so where would we go with something? Where would be a practical mission to use your sail?
You got to define practical when you're talking to me.
I know, you're a science fiction writer, so got to keep that in mind.
Okay. In the near term, I think we can use solar sails to send robotic probes pretty much all over the solar system.
Really?
Yeah, the Japanese are flying one now. It's called Icarus. It's flying in the inner solar system around Venus. You have to wonder if they know their Greek mythology to call it Icarus. But it was a 100% successful mission. The Planetary Society is going to be flying a sail this May. It's going to be in Earth orbit. And NASA has actually been investing in solar sails, and we have plans to fly a few in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. And how big a ship? Would it take football fields-sized sails to power these things?
Well, it depends on where you want to go.
Well, can you give me an example of where you want to go?
In the near term, I think we're talking sails that might be a few tens of meters to hundreds of meters on a side. If you want to go to the stars, really go to the stars.
Let's think big.
You got to think big. Think a sail thinner than a human hair, for those that aren't as follically challenged as I am, and the size of the state of Texas.
Okay? State of Texas?
Yeah, think about a sail that large. Now, we have no idea how to build that. I will not claim I know how to build a sail that large. But I will tell you that Mother Nature has not said it's impossible. You can look at the properties of light and what we're learning about materials and advanced carbon fiber materials, and you can see that perhaps someday we might be able to spin these things like a spider web in space. get them to fly very, very close to the sun, and maybe also push them with extra kick by big lasers, and get them going fast enough that you could have a realistic trip time to the stars.
But once you get out of the solar system, you're going to lose the sun, basically.
That's right. You sure do.
So your sail, what happens to your sail?
Well, you get most of your kick in close to the sun. I mean, you have the advantage of this thing called the inverse square law, which means if you cut the distance to the sun in half, you don't get twice as much thrust. You get four times as much thrust. So if you deploy this big sail really close to the sun, get a really big kick, and on its way out of the solar system, you take a big laser, or several of them, that are getting energy from the sun, and focus that light on the sail, you can keep accelerating as it's leaving. So it goes really fast.
Wow. I'm Ira Plato, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So as a science fiction writer, and as other science fiction writers have written, do you think that scientists, your science side, is informed by science fiction to think big and think of ideas like this as people use science fiction?
I can speak personally. Yeah. I decided to study physics and go to work to NASA because of Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, and Arthur C. Clarke, some of the great science fiction writers. I was in a workshop among my NASA colleagues not too long ago, and we were all asked to name the number one influence to our careers, and two words popped out, and they were Star and Trek. So, absolutely. So I was inspired by it, and that's what motivated me, and now I'm actually trying to make that happen in my science fiction writing. I try to go back, and I kind of view it as full circle. I'm now trying to get that next generation inspired.
So. Are we going to get warp speed someday?
I'm very skeptical of this whole warp drive thing.
Tell us why.
To me, I don't mind talking about things that are outlandishly difficult to engineer but are within the realm of what we know about how nature seems to work today, and warp drive is kind of outside of that. And maybe someday we don't know everything there is to know about how nature works. I hope you prove me wrong, you next generation of physicists, and come up with that. But right now, I'm not counting on it.
You'll stick with a flux capacitor. But
I'll take that.
You'll take that one.
And the Mr. Fusion to go with it. That would be really good.
It's always 30 years away. Ever notice?
Yeah,
that?
I know.
Fusion
I know.
Is always 30 years away, no matter what happens. One of your books, Back to the Moon.
Yeah.
Involves a secret mission to the moon, and it uses something called air-breathing rockets. I thought that was the opposite definition of a rocket. I thought a rocket doesn't have to breathe air. How does that work?
There are different ways you can think about getting to space. And right now we primarily use rockets. But the dream of a certain aspect of the community is that you can actually offload some of that propellant, which is heavy, and maybe use oxygen from the air and essentially take an engine that lets you use your environment here in the atmosphere to accelerate and get to space. And we don't have anything that can go multiple times the speed of sound and get you to orbit at those velocities today. But in the book, we postulated that somebody finds a way to actually make it work. That's the fiction part of the science fiction, right? And the story goes from there. So it makes it reusable. And the idea is that this company found a way to do this, and they truly have a commercial airline-like process for taking people into space.
Do you think that it's going to be private people, Elon Musk, other people like that, who are going to get us to these planets?
Oh, I'm very optimistic that somebody's going to be able to do that. I think in the near term, it'll be close to Earth. It'll be the Alan Shepard kind of flights up and back.
Right.
I think we'll eventually see people taking tourist flights to the moon. And it's my hope, while commercial space is doing those things, that NASA and the other space agencies are going to that next step and sending people further out into the solar system.
How about, Mars is the next logical step. Do you think we will see it, you and I, in our
life? I have hoped my whole life to see it. Before I came up here today, I was talking to someone about a book that was given to me by my first supervisor at NASA before he retired. And it's a collection of papers from a symposium here in Huntsville, 1964, looking about how we go to Mars and the challenges for that. And the introduction to Von Braun wrote for that volume could be read today. And the good thing is, we have taken a lot of those challenges that they didn't know how to do, and we can put a check mark by that today.
But just can
we know how to do that.
Well, okay. But we could put a check mark by it, but can we put a checkbook by it?
That's beyond me to answer. I'm hoping that things like by writing the book Rescue Mode and other things, we can keep people excited into what if.
Yeah.
And I believe we can. And I think part of it is showing relevance. I think it'll become inevitable that we take that next step to go to the planets and from there to the stars.
I hope that Absolutely. You are right. Thank you very much, Les, for taking time to be with us today. Les Johnson, a NASA technologist at the Marshall Space Flight Center. He's also co-author of Rescue Mode and Back to the Moon. Thanks again for
Thank
being
you.
With us today. We have to take a quick break. And playing us to the break, Huntsville's own Microwave Dave and Jim Cavender. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. We won't be taking your calls today, but if you'd like to join our conversation this week, you can tweet us at SciFry or leave us a comment at sciencefriday.com. Now, here at Science Friday, we're all about the rigorous pursuit of truth through the application of the scientific method. So with that in mind, I'd like to present to you this cat video from YouTube.
So here's what's interesting about this to me. If you'll notice at the beginning of the drop, the cat is not rotating. Halfway through the drop, the cat is rotating, and then at the very end, Gigi somehow stops rotating. Newton's first law says that an object at rest will stay at rest unless acted on by an external force. I see no external forces on this cat. So what's happening here? It's not making sense to me.
In case you couldn't tell, that's not your average internet cat video. That's the beginning of a physics explanation using high-speed video and a house cat as a test subject for why cats always seem to land on their feet. And don't worry, no kitties were harmed during the making of this film. It's one of the more than 100 videos my next guest, Destin Sandlin, created since he launched Smarter Every Day, his YouTube science channel. By day, Destin's a missile flight test engineer at the Redstone Arsenal here in Huntsville. But by night, he uses a powerful high-speed camera to unpack the science behind everyday mysteries, like how tattooing works and why spaghetti snaps the way it does. Destin, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Tell us how you started making these videos.
Oh, goodness gracious. It just kind of happened. It was like a fire in my bones, and I had to do it or I would explode kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That makes a big mess, so I'm glad you
did. It does. I really like to teach, and I like to explore the world using science. And then my wife brought home a laptop with video editing software. And so I made a video called How to Light a Bonfire with Rockets, as you do.
Of course.
Yeah,
it's
of course.
The first thing I would do
yeah,
when I got it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I made that video, and I put it up just for some friends, and they liked it. And I don't know. I just started.
And you've had some great videos. The first one I want to show today, I think, is probably a great hit. A video called Chicken Head Tracking.
Oh, this.
Let's.
Thank
yes,
you.
Let's
Thank
watch
you for doing
a bit
this.
Of that.
It's a chicken. I got my dad a chicken for Father's Day. And I want to show you a pretty interesting method that chickens have to keep their head stable. You know, in guidance and control, you have feedback loops. And so you have to know your position and where your relative motion is going so you can compensate for it. But chickens are really good at this. So I'll show you. Watch his head stay totally stationary as I move his body. I can move his body in pretty much any direction, and his head stays rock solid in one position.
Yeah. So you're going to start right out of the gate with a chicken video. I see how this is going to go.
Well, besides the fact that everybody buys their father a chicken for Father's Day.
Yeah.
Describe what happened in the movie. People on the radio who can't see what was going on. It was quite dramatic.
Okay, so I made this video because I observed this, right? You know, we live in Alabama. Of course, you get your dad a chicken for Father's Day, right? And so I started moving the chicken around, and I had just got out of some guidance and control classes. I was working on my master's degree. And so for me, this was this really deep, intense thing, because when I would move the base of the chicken, the head of the chicken would stay still. And I noticed I could move it in any direction, and it would stay in one spot and never move.
Like a gyroscopic head.
Exactly, like a Steadicam for the chicken.
It's
like
a personal Steadicam
for the chicken, exactly. And so I started thinking about this, and I'm thinking like rocket guidance and control, right? And so I make this video, and I'm like on this really deep differential equations level, and then everybody in the comments just talks about how redneck I am. And so I'm like, no, but there's this, you know, vestibular ocular reflex in the chickens, and they're like, we don't care, you're a redneck with a chicken, but it's awesome.
Is that the reason why a chicken moves its head so funny at first places when it walks?
Exactly. What's
going on there?
Yeah, so what the chicken's doing is he'll walk by putting his head forward and then running his body in under it, and then he'll move and do it again. And so I started thinking about this, and you can actually back drive the reflex. If you put your hand in front of a chicken and just let him lock on visually with it, and then move your hand, he'll start moving his head to wherever your hand is going. So he's back driving that same reflex. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Spend a lot of time with chickens. I can see that.
I do. We actually had 3 new ones last weekend. Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, it's
but
a big
the
deal.
It was very popular. This had 3 million views.
Something like that. I don't know.
Did that change your way you approach videos, the success of this?
You know, it actually did. So I figured something out at that. That was the first video that ever went pretty big, right? And I realized that I could kind of slide a spoonful of vegetables in with the dessert at that moment in time. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
and so I'm interested in science and science education. And so I figured out at that moment in time that if I could make it entertaining at the same time as I was educating, then I could get people to learn things that they normally don't care about.
Hmm. And, you know, and people who watch your channel now on YouTube, they know that you love these high-tech toys.
We do.
And your coolest toy, I think, is the high-speed camera. How did you get a hold of a high-speed camera, first of all?
Well, that's a good question. Well, so let's go. Can we go all the way back?
All the way back.
Let's get in the way back
to
machine.
Fire. We'll go back to the invention of fire, yeah.
So I remember sitting in my biology class in 9th grade, which was taught by Mrs. English, and I was looking at my physics book, right? And so I was
in there.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying. Yeah. So I was looking at my book, and I saw a picture by a guy named Doc Edgerton from MIT, the master of high-speed photography, right? So Doc Edgerton, he invented all these different high-speed cameras and the stroboscopic photography technique. It's amazing. I looked at a picture of a bullet going through an apple, and I said, I don't know what the heck this is, what kind of sorcery did this, but I want to learn that. And so fast forward, you know, 10 years after my bachelor's degree, and I'm interviewing for a job, and they said, yeah, so we use these high-speed cameras to test rockets. And I'm like, you don't have to pay me. I'm working here, you know? And so once I started doing that, I learned how the cameras work. I just started using them. And then I was able to get a hold of one at home. And when I did that, I made a video about pistols underwater, and it just took off from there.
And so you borrowed one to take home from work.
I did not. As a scout's honor, as a good civil servant, a government employee, I would never do that because that would be fraud, waste, and abuse.
Uh-huh. Okay. So
yes.
Okay. I'll buy that.
That's right.
Let's move on to another video that you made. This is something also you can try at home. You did this experiment in your family van with your kids. Tell us what you did.
Basically, my dad called me again. This wasn't about a chicken. And he said, hey, you know, I've noticed this thing with a balloon. If I hang a balloon up in my vehicle and I drive forward, the balloon doesn't behave like a normal inertial type mass model like you would expect. It doesn't sway backwards. It actually sways forwards. And so we did this experiment with my children. And my personal goal is I want to see if I can figure out how to explain this complex concept to my 5-year-old son. And that was a challenge that I laid out for myself.
And so you had some helium balloons in your van. And normally when you have, you know, when we drive in the car and we turn right or we stop or accelerate, our bodies move back and forth.
Exactly. Like sometimes I hang my sunglasses on the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
And so when I turn left, I watch my sunglasses go to the right. And then sometimes I'll get them oscillating and I figure out how to stop it. And I'll quit talking now.
I like that. I have to do that.
I do science when I listen to Science Friday.
I'm a little
Friday.
Stealthy geek. I'm like you, but I keep it a little quiet, like, you know.
I understand.
I don't advertise it that much, but I'm just as interested in that kind of thing. We'll talk later, you know.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
But this what happens with the helium, though, is the balloons act just the opposite of the way your body is shifting, don't they?
They do.
What's going on? Why is that?
Okay, so if you think about it, your car is a closed system, right?
Yeah.
It's like its own little, you know, nothing in, nothing out. Well, there's air in the car, and the air in the car behaves like a fluid, right? So here, I've got a water bottle in my hand right now. So if I'm holding this water bottle in the hand and I accelerate towards that end of the stage, away from you, you'll notice that all the water sloshes to the back of the bottle.
Right.
Okay, so if you do it the opposite way, it'll all slosh back to that one side. So the air in the vehicle behaves just like the water in this bottle. So when you accelerate, you're pushing air to the back of the vehicle, and the air pressure, according to fluid dynamics, the air pressure in the back of the vehicle is just a little bit higher than the pressure in the forward part of the vehicle.
So that's going to push the balloon forward because it's higher pressure back there.
Well, it's actually creating flow. Uh-huh. And so what I like to, the way I like to explain it is it's pushing back and then that helium, because it's lighter, you have a buoyancy type effect, and the helium is going forward. Does that make sense? Just like the same reason it
try
floats.
Try it. Everybody can try this. Take some helium balloons, put them in your car, drive it around. It's
beautiful.
Counterintuitive.
It really is.
Counterintuitive. All right, we're going to learn something now, something new, because you've got a brand new episode of Smarter Every Day and involves this bike here that you brought with you.
That's right.
This is not your average bike, right?
No. This bike, this has caused me a lot of pain, actually.
Literally?
Literally. This bike has caused me a lot of pain.
Why is that?
Well, this started a long time ago. I work at the range there at Redstone Arsenal, and I got a call from a welder down at the other end of the range, and he said, hey, Destin, I need you to come down here and ride my bike. And then he starts laughing. And when a grown man starts giggling in his coffee cup and tell you to come ride a bike, that gets weird quick, right? And so I went down there, and he had created this monstrosity. It's not a normal bicycle. Do you want
to? Yeah, let's go down. I'll take my portable mic and we'll walk down to the bike. It looks like an old Schwinn.
Yeah, pretty much. I like the style, but there's one major difference in it. When you turn the handlebar to the right, the wheel goes to the left. And when you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. So it's pretty simple, right? That makes sense.
It looks pretty simple, you know. Well, so you get on, you just have to adjust it a little bit, and you're riding immediately.
Yeah, exactly. So what you do is, you know, you just tell your brain, you know, you're the control algorithm for riding a bike. You know, it's just like riding a bike, right? Only you just change one part. So you've got this huge control algorithm, and just flip that one variable, and you're good to go, right?
Right.
Well, I've got my brother-in-law over here. Is it okay if we let him have a go at it?
Sure.
Is it acceptable?
But what's your name?
Sean.
Sean, have you ridden this bike before?
One time I tried a few months ago when he was practicing, because I got to see how awful we both were.
I don't know if we're insured for this. We'll try and see what happens. All right, so
Sean, just to make this interesting, so you see that fern over there, that green plant? I will mow your yard for the rest of the summer if you can make it to that fern. All right, let's give it a go.
Fell right off. And I bet most people think they can just get on and ride it, right?
Right. I've actually taken this bicycle all over the world, and I do this what I'm doing right now. I show people the bike, and I say, ride it 10 feet. Nobody can do it. Especially the big macho guys. They're like, of course I can do it. And of course, later after the show, they almost kill themselves trying, right? It actually took me 8 months to learn how to ride this bicycle.
Just to prove that you can ride this bicycle.
I think you understand. I think you understand how my brain works. Yeah, so the way this works, go ahead and kick the kickstand there, Sean. So the way it works is I instantly realized when Barney the welder, he had me on this bike, and I realized how difficult it was. It was a personal challenge because I understood that I had a certain way of thinking, and I had been thinking the same way my entire life. I realized at that moment I had to build a bike, and I had to figure out how to ride it, and it took me 8 months to do that.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. All right, let's see you ride this. Okay. Would you want to see him ride this bike? Okay. Oh, you see, he's putting a helmet on. That tells you something already.
Yeah, the Space and Rocket Center want me to wear a helmet. That's what that tells you. And I'm a rule follower. So,
we've got about 10 yards of room for you to ride this. Let's see what happens.
Are you going
to
mow my yard for the rest of the summer? If I...
Look at that. Well, he's doing it. Go on, right when you get work. Come on, back. Now you have to work at it, though, but you know what to do. You're sort of like pedaling the handlebars.
Well, it's really weird because for the first 5 months, I could get maybe 6 or 7 feet, and I'd have a phone in my pocket, and as soon as the phone would ring, I would crash. So it's a brain thing. So the algorithm for riding a bike is way more complicated than I ever thought, because when you push on a pedal, your weight is shifting. And so that's a different input into the equation. I mean, it's crazy. It's very, very difficult. So I don't know. That's it. One thing that's interesting about this, though, is my son had just recently learned how to ride a bike. He was 5 years old. I mean, like, the normal way, right? And so I wanted to experiment and see how good his brain was at adapting to change compared to my brain. And so we built him a bike the same way. And I told him, I was like, look, we're going to go to Australia, and we're going to meet Chris Hadfield, an astronaut. He wants to see if you can ride this bike, right? It took him, what was it, 2 weeks to do the same thing. So it took me 8 months to learn how to ride this backwards bike. It took my 5-year-old 2 weeks. So what does that tell you?
I don't want to go there, believe me.
Very good. Well, what it told me is that younger children have, you know, a totally different type of neuroplasticity than we do.
Yeah, I was just playing with it. I agree with you. It's kids. they have, yeah. This is fantastic, Destin. Thank you for bringing the bike. And we're not going to let anybody, I don't think. Well, maybe we'll let a few people in the audience ride the bike. Destin Sandlin is creator of the YouTube science series Smarter Every Day. He's also a missile flight test engineer. So what? Here in Huntsville, Alabama.
It's all about
Thanks
cats
again,
and
Destin,
chickens.
For joining us. And you can watch Destin ride this reverse bike in the new video and watch all the videos we talk about today. If you go to our website, sciencefriday.com/smarter-every-day.
Thank you.
That's about all the time we have. I'd like to give a special shout out to everyone at Huntsville Public Radio, especially Brett Tannehill and Carl Sampieri, and Roy Clem and Phil Hutchison, and all the folks at Alabama Public Television as APT celebrates its 60th anniversary this year. And our friends here at U.S. Space and Rocket Center, including Dr. Deborah Barnhart, Chris Brothers, and Tim Hall. And of course, Microwave Dave and Jim Cavender on the guitars. Special thanks to Bob Isaacson and our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And to Redstone Federal Credit Union for all their support. And we can't forget our Science Friday staff, Charles Berquist, Jen Connor, Daniel Dana, Brandon Ector, Jennifer Fennick, Becky Fogel, Sarah Goldfarb, Luke Graskin, Christopher Taliata, Jen Kwok, Julie Leibach, Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Annie Nero, Christian Scotta, Chow Tu, and Ariel Zitch. In Huntsville, Alabama, I'm Ira Flato.